From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the company that had pet coke piled along the Detroit River last year now says it wants bigger piles of other products.
To look at a 40-foot pile of pet coke and replace it with a 100-foot pile of anything, you know, it's going to raise concerns.
Plus, a chance for healthcare professionals to learn about environmental health risks.
Health professionals need to be more active in what are those risks and helping the consumer make good choices.
And we take a fresh look at our national anthem.
It really is a kind of story of America because we're complicated. We've had to compromise. We have all these different voices, all these different people coming together that have made this democratic experiment really work. And for me, the song tells that same story in a sort of vivid and emotional and fun way.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this very, very cold day. Our national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, turns 200 this year. Today, we hear about a project that is highlighting the dozens and dozens of versions of this song, the different lyrics and melodies, and most important, the fascinating story of our nation's history. Then, as more and more people are questioning the safety of the chemicals around us, health leaders are trying to understand these risks. We'll hear about a new statewide program that aims to train health professionals about environmental health risks and activism. That story later this hour. But first, the company that had pet coke piled along the Detroit River last year now says it wants bigger piles of other products. At a meeting of the Detroit Board of Zoning Appeals yesterday, there were some verbal fireworks, some confusion, and a lot of scrutiny because that hearing involved that company that was home to the massive piles of pet coke last summer. The pet coke, you'll recall, is a byproduct of refining heavy crude oil brought in by pipeline from Alberta. The people who had to live near four-story piles of this stuff and breathe in clouds of pet coke dust last year before the stuff was moved out are watching closely to see if Detroit Bulk Storage is trying to get pet coke back onto the Detroit riverfront. Dave Battagello has been tracking this story for the Windsor Star. Dave, what happened at the Board of Zoning Appeals meeting?
Well, it was quite a bit of confusion. It started off and everybody was anticipating a debate on petroleum coke, or pet coke as it's known. But then right away, a lawyer representing Detroit Bulk Storage stood up and made a comment that they weren't there to appear before the board on the issue of pet coke. So everybody's jaw kind of hit the floor, and she quickly redirected the hearing into looking at the issue of storing piles of other materials on the site. And she listed a number of them, and she wants the materials, a variance granted by the city, so the materials could go not four stories, but this time 10 stories high.
So we are talking about something in the area of 100 feet high, piles of stuff that they'd like to store.
Yeah, that's the variance they're kind of moving towards. So the board was kind of stunned by the change in direction. Other people onlooking the hearing were also kind of caught off guard. There was, probably about 100 people there on the issue of pet coke. And then when this change of direction happened, nobody quite knew what to think at first.
What kind of products could they give them a complete list of what they'd want to store, or did they just give them some for instance?
Well, it was a little bit of a list. It was kind of in between. They suggested salt. They suggested asphalt, limestone, a couple of other materials. And then at the end, they also mentioned other similar materials. So when the board heard that, then everybody's guard kind of went up, that wondering if it was going to be a backdoor kind of situation to get petroleum coke back on the riverfront.
Interesting. So it was quite a curveball. And then I understand there was a surprise for everyone, including the city, to discover just who the property owner of that riverfront lot is and what he claims he thought about the pet coke that was piled there last summer.
Well, that was part of the whole confusing message brought forth by the lawyer from Detroit Bulk Storage. There were several other lawyers in attendance, and towards the end of the hearing, they stood up and made some comments as well. One of those lawyers was actually the CFO from Crown Enterprises, which is a real estate company which is owned by Matty Maroon, the Ambassador Bridge owner. Matty Maroon, I've been reporting for quite a while that he is indeed the owner of that property. The bridge company and Mr. Maroon have pointed to having little control of that land, however, pointing to Norfolk Southern, the railway company, as being the operator of the land, and pointing to that railway company cutting the lease with Detroit Bulk Storage.
So did we get the sense from the gentleman from Crown Enterprises, from Ronald Patty, that, Mr. Maroon never wanted that pet coke on the land?
He tried to portray that message, and that kind of set everybody was kind of frustrated or angry at those type of comments. Because everybody knows Mr. Maroon and his long history in dealing with communities, and he's very much a businessman. And if he owns that property and there was something he didn't like, he's also very litigious. And if he didn't like what was going on there, not 5 seconds would go by where he wouldn't get a lawyer and get the stuff removed. So when people heard that Mr. Maroon's against storing any of these materials there, including petroleum coke, they obviously got their back up in a hurry. Because Mr. Maroon, if he truly didn't want that material there, would have taken a number of steps or actions.
Well, let's take a listen now as Michigan Representative Rashida Tlaib, who represents those Southwest Detroit residents who were living right near those massive piles of pet coke last summer. Let's take a listen as she laid into Ronald Patty of the Maroon Company.
You should have been able to stop him polluting our community.
I'm in there right now, am I not?
No, you came
You're
in there.
You're pointing fingers.
But you came in there.
Make an inaccurate acquisition.
That's okay. Prove me
I'm
wrong.
Not an attorney.
Prove the ownership.
I'm here.
You own the property.
We are
be
the owner of the property.
Be responsible.
I'm here, am I not?
Then, hey, can my community go on your property right now and pollute?
What
you probably kick us off. Kick them off.
Ms. Tlaib, I hope you see that we're
kick
here being proactive.
No, you can go to court and take them off. Evict them like any other landlord would. Evict them off the property.
So, Dave Battagiello, is that a sense that people like Rashida Tlaib feel that it's a little disingenuous of the Maroon people to claim that Maddie never wanted that stuff on the land?
Yeah, Rashida totally gets the picture. She's been following this situation along with a number of others revolving around Mr. Maroon. So she understands fully what the situation is and who the true owner is and who's really in control of those lands. I think for her, for a lawyer from one of the entities under Mr. Maroon, there's probably hundreds of companies that he owns, and for an official or a lawyer from any one of those companies to stand up and make comments that he's, that they don't agree with what's going on with one of those properties, well, maybe you don't, but Mr. Maroon certainly does because he's taken those steps to get rid of materials on that land.
I'm speaking with Windsor Star reporter Dave Battagiello, who is following the whole issue of the owners of the land where that pet coke was last summer. And I know those piles of pet coke were a big concern, not just for the people in Southwest Detroit, but your story for the Windsor Star makes it very clear that people in Windsor weren't fans. I particularly like the quote from the MP for West Windsor, basically saying, here we are trying to improve our waterfront. And then instead, it's welcome to Windsor. Come see the worst of Alberta.
Yeah, that was MP Brian Massey, and that's truly the situation. I mean, we're not talking a great distance here. The Detroit River is less than a mile across, probably about half a mile if you just count the shore to shore. And so to see a four-story pile grow daily of this black material, first of all, raised questions. It looks like coal at first from our side of the river. And I was one of the first to go over there and actually take a look at this stuff with a photographer. And then when you smelled it, when you actually saw what it was, and then when it was reported on exactly what it was, everybody here was a bit of an uproar because you could see it as it was loading onto ships blowing into the river. You could see it when storms cropped up, blowing off the pile in all directions. There are video clips online. And so when people saw this, it's been a concern for months now on that material and the impact it was having on both the river and on people.
But, Dave, I can't imagine anybody would welcome 100-foot piles of limestone or salt or asphalt at all.
Well, and that's certainly the case. I mean, to look at a 40-foot pile of pet coke and replace it with a 100-foot pile of anything, you know, it's going to raise concerns. So the board yesterday in Detroit did the right thing. They sent it back to administration to study any of the materials that Detroit Bulk Storage is suggesting may go on those lands. They want a full environmental assessment by the city administrators to determine the impact to both the river and people so they can make an informed decision.
I did see one comment somewhere from an official from Detroit Bulk Storage saying, well, you know, there are only so many properties along the Detroit River that can handle deep water freighters. Here we are. And by the way, if you convert an industrial building into lofts, that's fine and good, but you're still in an industrial area.
Well, the industrial area there, it's right on the edge. If you go a little further downriver towards River Rouge, towards E-Course, it's heavy industrial all the way through. You have Zug Island in the middle of that. There's a number of locations where if you really need to do this stuff, it's a better situation than right next to the bridge in Detroit. You have Windsor's already moved to create their entire riverfront into parkland, and now you have millions of dollars being spent in Detroit to kind of mirror what we already have in Windsor. By the month, you see riverlands improving in Detroit, and I think there's a large group of people that want that to progress and become a bit of a tourist destination, or even for their own residents to be a better, more beautiful place to be. And to put a 100-foot pile of anything next to that or right in the middle of it doesn't speak well for anybody.
So, Dave, what should we watch for, and what kind of timetable is happening as far as subsequent meetings?
Well, this board yesterday adjourned the issue until April. They didn't give a specific date, but it's going to give their city administration a couple months to sort through all of this to determine exactly what materials Detroit Bulk Storage is suggesting go on that property, including the issue of petroleum coke. Everybody still believes or has their guard up that the true agenda here is to get petroleum coke back on that site. So Detroit administration and their legal team is going to investigate this a little further, have a lot of conversations with Detroit Bulk Storage, and I'm sure get a very clearly defined list on exactly what's going to go on that site, and also study how high those piles should be before it starts to have a detrimental impact on people and or the river.
Dave Battagello of the Windsor Star. Dave, thanks so much.
Not a problem. It's good talking with you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It can be one of the most stirring and glorious melodies ever sung, and it can be one of the easiest tunes to mangle. Our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, turning 200 this year. The history of this tune is absolutely fascinating. And now the University of Michigan presents Poets and Patriots, a tuneful history of the Star-Spangled Banner. Mark Clegg is a musicologist with the University of Michigan. Real good to have you back on the program, Mark.
Great to be here, Cindy.
In fact, we last spoke with you about the big Gershwin project you're working on, and you said, I've got something coming up about the Star-Spangled Banner. So what does this project try to accomplish?
Well, basically, the Star-Spangled Banner is turning 200 years old this year in September, and I've been getting ready for this day for like 10 years. I mean, I just want to have the biggest birthday party possible for the national anthem. And I think what's really interesting to me about it is that the story behind this ritual that we know from every sporting event, from
sure
graduations,
enough.
We sing it all the time. We sing it so much that, in fact, we don't really know much about this song at all.
No.
And it turns out that the story of Francis Scott Key and this anthem and the actual dozens and dozens of versions of lyrics to this and different melodies and changes in musical style and approach, I just find it endlessly engaging for me, and it really gets at this issue of the power of this song. I mean, I think for me personally, but for so many of us.
Well, it's persisted. We haven't thrown it out and replaced
Absolutely.
It when you think about it all these years.
Exactly. There are lots of reasons why people don't like the Star-Spangled Banner. It's too hard to sing. It's associated with war. You know, it has this reputation as a drinking song.
These
sort of this colored history and colorful history. And I think that's, for me, what's really cool is that when you start to get into it, it really is a kind of story of America because we're complicated. We've had to compromise. We have all these different voices, all these different people coming together that have made this democratic experiment really work. And for me, the song tells that same story in a sort of vivid in an emotional and fun way.
Well, take us through first the history of the melody before it became something that Francis Scott Key knew enough about to be able to set his lyrics to. So do we know who the composer is and who and when it was written? Who wrote it and when?
We do. So it actually dates from the time of our own Revolutionary War, 1775-76. And I think it's sort of fun. The composer's name is probably the sort of ultimate American name, even though This guy is an English composer. His name is John Smith. So John Stafford Smith, to be accurate. And he was a church musician and a professional keyboardist, harpsichordist, but he also was an award-winning composer of popular song. And so this amateur musicians club that was a pretty, you know, classy and classical group of men who would get together, have a symphony concert, have a big dinner, and then sing songs for the rest of the evening, they would introduce the song portion of the evening with their club anthem. And so the Anacreontic song is a story, and it has lots of allusions to sort of Greek mythology and the poet Anacreon. And Stafford Smith set this to music.
So did the lyrics exist and then he matched the music, or did he come up with the melody first?
That's a good question. I think probably the lyrics were written first and then the melody was done to match it. So the lyrics were written by a member of the club, Rafe Tomlinson. The music and the popularity of the club really explode at the same time, such that although this is a club song, it becomes parodied in theaters in London and becomes known in the early United States as well. So Francis Scott Key knew this tune. One of the myths I'm trying to correct about the story that we don't really know about the Star-Spangled Banner is that it wasn't someone else who put text and tune together. It was Francis Scott Key. I mean, you don't accidentally write a lyric to this really what's a sort of a funny melody. It's eight lines long. It has nine rhymes and eight lines. I mean, it's a very specific poetic form. And it was a very popular poetic form. So what Francis Scott Key does is something we call the broadside ballad tradition. And it's something, you know, we're not so familiar with today where you can, you know, record, you have recording and you can put stuff out on the internet. If you want to celebrate a song, you just put it out there.
Sure.
You know, in like, you know, 1814 when this song was written, publishing music, there's no recording extant, right? It's expensive to put out music notation. So what you did is you just put lyrics in the newspaper and you gave a hint of a popular melody that everybody already knew, and they sang the day's events. You know, something you wanted to celebrate, you know, some kind of event, a birthday, an anniversary, or in the case of Francis Scott Key, an unexpected and pivotal victory in the War of 1812.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan musicologist Mark Clegg as we talk about the Poets and Patriots Project that is really taking us all through the years in the history of our national anthem. And I'm interested in how this song that was banged out by Francis Scott Key to celebrate, as you say, a pivotal victory in the War of 1812, how did it make its way from being a patriotic chest thumper to the national anthem of the United States of America, a very lofty position?
Well, it took a long time. It took 117 years. So it doesn't become the official national anthem until, believe it or not, 1931. So it hasn't even been a century since it's been our national anthem. People think, oh, it must be like 1776.
Absolutely.
But no, it's actually quite recent. But it, in many ways, the story of our recordings is that it became the national anthem for all practical purposes long before the government got around to recognizing it and President Hoover signed
like a de facto national anthem.
Exactly. So it's really, it starts right in the aftermath of the War of 1812 and that victory. And there's sort of a beginning of sort of a coherent, you know, patriotism in the United States. And that's growing gradually up and through the Civil War. And the Civil War is sort of a key moment. At the beginning of the Civil War, interestingly enough, both the North and the South claim all of America's symbols for themselves. So the Confederacy is saying Francis Scott Key is one of ours. Yes. He's a Southerner. You know, he's from Maryland, the slave state. He's, you know, his family has been in this area forever, and this is our song and our flag. And in fact, we need to protect this sort of these wonderful symbols from the Yankees.
Yes. Right?
And then, of course, the Union is saying we need to keep everything together. We're going to use these symbols like the flag and the song as a way of pulling those together. So one of the sort of most interesting thing is that both sides write different lyrics using the Star Spangled Banner melody for campaign songs. There's a campaign song for Lincoln. There's a campaign song for his competitors, all, again, using that same tune. And we've recorded these. So there's a tune called The Flag of Secession, right, which is about the South breaking away.
The pumpkins for fair, the foul-feated air, gave proof through the night that the Yankees were there. Now the flag of secession in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the freed and the home of the brave.
And there's a song called Our Country's Free Flag,
guess
which is from
side
the North.
That's from.
Yeah, exactly. So both sides are using this melody as a way of getting their word out there and saying that what's at stake is the very identity of our country. And they're using this song and the flag that are so intimately married. You know, from the moment that Francis Scott Key sees that flag over Fort mm-hmm. McHenry, it's really, the song becomes the oral equivalent of the symbol of that canvas
flag. And the flag was still there.
The flag was still there. And so it's that marriage of flag and song that really has I think, put it so deeply into the American spirit.
This day, some stars have seceded and wandered away, and we go to reclaim them, this flag on our head. Free waving and warning with stripes of deep red.
Down through the years, Mark, have there been serious contenders to knock the Star-Spangled Banner off that front track of becoming our anthem? I mean, I think of the Battle Hymn of the Republic or America the Beautiful.
Right. The Star-Spangled Banner, because it's been the sort of witness to these pivotal moments in our sort of nation's history when the identity of the country has been at stake, I think it's become the national anthem really despite any kind of decision making. I mean, many people would love to see America the Beautiful be our national anthem. I mean, it's a gorgeous song.
Easier
it's sort
to
of
sing.
Spiritual. It sort of embraces the country from sea to shining sea. It's easier to sing, exactly. But, you know, the affect of that song is a kind of sort of reverie or reverence. And one of the things about a national anthem, I mean, the reason I think we sort of sing it before football games or baseball games, it's about, I mean, sports is a kind of ritual of war, right? You have different teams against each other. They're fighting it out. They're trying to be heroic. So there's this singing our national anthem, which has this really wide melody, right? It has what musicians would call an interval of the 12th. I mean, most national anthems are really narrow. You know, they're almost sort of dirges. You know, you're just very few notes, actually. Our national anthem has basically 12 notes from top to bottom. But the kind of effort and heroism, the vocal heroism, the kind of commitment it takes to make that melody come off, I think is part of the spirit that we need from a national anthem. We turn to a national anthem when the country feels threatened, when we have to really defend ourselves, when we have to make something happen. It's a kind of call to action. And I think the Star-Spangled Banner galvanizes people for action in a way that America the Beautiful probably really can't. So in peacetime, America Beautiful makes sense. Mm-hmm. In wartime, you need something different, and the Star-Spangled Banner fits that mold. And I don't see it going away, despite all of the reasons why we could say, well, you know, it's a British tune and it's, you know, it's sort of antiquated language and it's hard to sing and it's, you know, it has this drinking song reputation.
Mm-hmm.
22 of these 37 tracks, I think, it's the first time ever they've been recorded because they were written before recording was invented and then they were forgotten about. And, you know, it's amazing to me that I've found literally hundreds of lyrics to this song. Every time I dig in, we find another one. And it's really just an incredible, incredible story.
Well, as you know, there was grousing on the internet after the Super Bowl about Renee Fleming saying she didn't sing the national anthem the way it's supposed to be. But it lives in many forms. There's no one must sing it this way, right?
Right. So we've recorded the original version, the very first sheet music imprint of the Star-Spangled Banner, which we actually have at the University of Michigan in our Clements Library. It's one of 12 surviving copies. And it's actually the most valuable piece of sheet music in history. It's one piece of paper, folds in half, and it's worth $500,000 at auction, at least the most recent one. It doesn't get sold too often, as you'd imagine.
Wow.
And but this is from 1814, from that fall, probably mid-October. And it's actually the sheet music is the first time that the title, the Star-Spangled Banner, is used. Because, you know, Key's own title is In Defense of Fort McHenry. But I think it was a really savvy commercial move for the publisher to put that title on top because he could sell it to the whole country, not just to the people in Baltimore. And it's also a key move that allows us to have that song escape, you know, the sort of history of that one little banner,
that pigeon
battle.
Yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
And become something broader, sort of a more powerful symbol of our nation. But it features one of our students at the School of Music, Justin Berkowitz, and I've had the great fortune of having really an incredible talent pool at the School of Music here at Michigan to draw on, and they've been so generous, including my colleague Jerry Blackstone, who's our choral director, who led all of these recordings. But if you listen to it, it sounds very different. So it's a solo song. Right, it's not meant for mass singing, right? So originally it was the club president, and even in Key's day, it would have been sung by a fine vocalist you would have chosen to do the solo. And then there's an echo by chorus. So it's actually, you know, about an extra two phrases longer in its original version because that last line, you know, "Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave over the land of free and the home of the brave," that's repeated. First, it's sung by a soloist, and then it's repeated by the community, by the choir.
Almost like a little call and response.
Exactly. But it's a kind of affirmation, like, you know, this poem is here, and then the community sort of, you know, repeats and celebrates that lyric. It's a very different experience. The melody is different. It's much faster because initially it's a party tune, right? It's a song of celebration. We won, you know, as opposed to what it's become now, which is much more hymn-like, right? So it's slow. It's sacred. At the time, it's fast. It's exciting. It's meant to be a song of celebration. So, and the melodic contour is also a little different. I mean, there's subtle details, but it's really intriguing to hear. So when someone says, you know, Renee Fleming either was really traditional or really not traditional, it turns out there's no official version of the Star-Spangled Banner. So Jimi Hendrix is just as valid as Francis Scott Key's sort of original version as Fleming or anyone else. You know,
remember when Jose Feliciano did it during the World Series, the Tiger World Series in
68.
People were like, what?
In uproar. But for me, yes. that's the beauty and excitement of this, is that different people give voice to their own citizenship through the way they realize it. And so you can complain about it not being what you expect. But for me, that's what makes it really special, is that when we sing the song, we make a kind of commitment and a statement about who we are and where we belong. And I think it's that kind of personal commitment that really makes it shine.
You can find out more about the Poets and Patriots Project, order the CDs and the guide. Just go to starspangledmusic.org. Mark Clegg, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Great to be here, Cindy.
Mark Clegg is a musicologist with the University of Michigan and heads up the Poets and Patriots Project. Some might argue that there's nothing more American than baseball. Well, you know those ballpark Franks that go with it? They're Michigan-made.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
A lot of things we use, or in today's case, eat, have a made-in-Michigan pedigree that you may not know about. Joel Stone is the curator for the Detroit Historical Society. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
Very good. So we're going to talk about the ballpark Frank. We know they plump when you cook them, but I didn't know they were Michigan-born.
They were Michigan-born, and Michigan had kind of the best Frankfurters in the country, and the ballpark was a perfect example of that.
Now, I understand a Detroit-based company, High Grade Food Products, was already making those hot dogs in the 1950s, but how did they take on the name Ballpark Franks?
Yeah, that was Mary Ann Kirk, who was an employee at High Grade. She came up with the name, but it was a guy named Gustav Hoff who came up with the dog. Of course, hot dogs have been served at ballparks for, you know, several decades, and the Tigers were not happy with theirs. So the folks at Briggs Stadium approached High Grades, and Gus Hoff came up with the hot dog that then went on to become the ballpark Frank. And frankly, I think it was I think it was a wonderful marketing move. They tied to baseball, which for a product means summer and sports and good times and fun. So from that marketing standpoint, it was wonderful. And then the donor advertising company here in Detroit came up with the plump when you cook 'em slogan, and that just just set them apart from every other hot dog in the country.
So this really is an important Michigan creation.
Oh, it is. And now across the country, the ballpark Frank, you know, we can say it started right here in Detroit.
Joel Stone, curator for the Detroit Historical Society. You've made me hungry for a big, juicy ballpark Frank. Thank you, Joel.
All right. Thanks, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. It takes plenty of heavy lifting to become a physician, a nurse, a dietitian, or other healthcare professional. Long years of coursework and clinical training can leave little room to learn other important skills, the kind of skills that can make a health professional an important player in the public policy sphere and prepare to tackle some of our most urgent environmental health challenges. So the Ecology Center is offering a new fellowship program to train health professionals about effective civic engagement and environmental health risks. Rebecca Munich is with the Ecology Center. Hi, Rebecca.
Good to be here today.
And speaking of medical professionals, we have retired neonatal nurse Joyce Stein with us. Good to have you here, Joyce.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Rebecca, just tell us what exactly is the mission of the Health Leaders Fellowship?
Well, we at the Ecology Center work with health professionals like Joyce in our advocacy efforts to make sure that we're protecting children from toxic chemicals, reducing exposure to dirty energy emissions, and getting access to healthier food in our healthcare system. And what we have seen is that many of the health professionals we work with are interested in getting a little bit more training on these issues. And so that's the mission, is to provide the issue training on three very important environmental health issues, and then critical civic engagement training so that the health professionals can make an impact in their own communities and in the public policy sphere.
Because they certainly pack quite a punch. If you're an MD or you're a nurse with the neonatal nursing experience that you have, Joyce, to stand perhaps at a civic meeting or writing letters to legislators, you do pack quite a punch, don't you?
Yes, I think we do, and I don't think we take advantage of that enough. We spend so much time in screening or treatment, and we aren't really working on prevention, which is where the public policy realm comes in. And health leaders need to really be more active in saying, what are these health implications? The program is going to be identifying things such as toxic chemicals or climate change. You know, what are the health impacts?
And these things are not really covered in nursing school or med school or...
Not really. You know, usually when you're in school, you're focusing on a specific patient who has a specific illness. You know, and these things, though they have very individual health outcomes, they're really global exposures. And so as population exposures, health professionals need to be more active in what are those risks and helping the consumer make good choices.
And what do you think this lack of training or lack of awareness means in terms of the kind of care patients are getting, and also what's being done to keep people healthy?
I think it's really difficult for a health professional when they're in the clinic setting to address many of these issues. I mean, you only have, and Joyce could speak to this, only mm-hmm. have a few moments with the patient. So in order to do something like take an environmental health history, that's difficult to work in. And many folks may not even, you know, be considering it. And so I think the importance here is to give our fellows that will come through the program a little bit of time to see how they can use these new skill sets in different ways and affect public health at a different level than one-on-one with a patient, perhaps, but making sure we have policies that protect our health to begin with.
So having the kind of information that and training that can be had in this fellowship, Joyce, what would that do, and how what kind of difference would that make in that day-to-day interaction with patients and their families?
Well, as a neonatal nurse mm-hmm. working with babies and pregnant women, now with more media exposure on chemicals, you know, some of the questions they ask, is this a safe product? Is that a safe product? You know, what things should I avoid? So health professionals don't get that in our training. So, you know, we're learning just like the public is. So the Health Leaders Program, I think, will help us tackle more specifically what are the specific health illnesses that we need to be focusing on in order to help counsel our patients.
I'm speaking with retired neonatal nurse Joyce Stein, who spent many decades taking care of neonates at the University of Michigan Hospital. And then Rebecca Munich is here. She's with the Ecology Center, talking about this fellowship program, a new fellowship program to train health professionals about effective civic engagement and the environmental health risks. Tell us about what does this fellowship entail? Is there a cost, and what kind of time commitment's needed?
So the fellowship is designed to be, hopefully, to be as friendly as we can to health professionals' schedules. And so we'll have a series of webinars and then a few in-person meetings. We think it's really important for the health professionals that we work with to really build a cohort of colleagues, a network of peers that they can go to. So there are 4 in-person mm-hmm. meetings or lectures. 2 of them are actually field experiences where we'll take our fellows to Lansing so they can get some civic engagement training there, talk to lawmakers on the issues that they care about. And another would be to visit a healthcare system and see what actually can be happening within the hospital to green the institution and make it a healthier place for both the patients and the health professionals who work there. And as I said, there'll be webinars that will be accessible for folks to watch so they don't have to necessarily come in mm-hmm. each time. So I think that'll make it a little easier. There's no cost to the program. There actually is a small stipend that we'll offer our fellows for their practicum project that we'll work with them on. It's a guided practicum in an issue area that is important to them on these environmental health issues that will help them write letters to the editor, for example, about an issue or meet with a lawmaker on that to get them hands-on training that way.
Who are you hoping will sign up for this fellowship?
Well, we're open to a lot of different types of health professionals. My personal favorite are nurses. We've had applications already from quite a few nurses. We've got interest from pediatricians and other physicians. Dietitians are really important, especially with our food on healthy food and healthcare. And so we're open to a wide range of health professionals, midwives and everyone. So,
and from all over Michigan?
From all over Michigan. As I mentioned, there's mm-hmm. four-day commitment, but it's over the course of 9 months. So we try to make that very accessible to folks. And so hopefully they can come and join us for the 2 sessions in Ann Arbor and the others across the state.
Is there any movement toward getting in on the ground level, if you will, in nursing school or in medical school to try to get coursework that would actually focus the students' attention on these environmental health? Is that something that could happen?
Yeah, actually there is. There's a lot of programs in the public community health nursing programs and such that do have the book work, mm-hmm. But you're not seeing the taking it to the next level. I mean, I'm still dealing with premature infants and their different health issues, but I'm not getting the tools to advocate to prevent those. And this is what we're looking at. You know, these environmental exposures are having impacts on our health, whether it's asthma, cancer, and we need to take an advocacy position that's going to help prevent that. It's not enough to just screen for it and then treat it, but if we haven't done anything to prevent it. So it's educating the healthcare professionals now on what are all the prevention strategies and exposure that are causing illnesses that we need to work on at a policy level.
And know how to talk to those folks in Lansing and at the local level who are the decision makers and the
exactly.
policy setters. What do you hope, Rebecca, will be the payoff for the people of Michigan after these doctors and nurses and nutritionists and other healthcare professionals have gone through the fellowship? What do you hope will be the payoff?
I hope that we can see some positive movement in public policy, either at the state or the national level, or even within various cities where these health professional fellows live. Mm-hmm. What we know from Gallup poll after Gallup poll is that health professionals such as nurses are some of the most trusted voices in our society. And so I think that with all of that trust behind them, that they can really make a difference in advocating for better public health policy to protect children, to protect our environment, our precious Great Lakes here. So that's what I hope to see out of this. I hope to see greener hospitals. We also know that nurses and other health professionals have higher levels of toxic chemicals in their bodies than many of us do in our regular lives and day jobs. And so I'd like to see those exposure levels go down for health professionals as well.
And you can learn more about the Health Leaders Fellowship by going to the Ecology Center website. It's very easy, ecocenter.org. That's ecocenter.org. And we should remind all healthcare professionals who are listening, the deadline for application to this free program is this Friday, Valentine's Day. Rebecca and Joyce, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There has been a lot of talk, some of it right here on the stateside, about opportunities for entrepreneurs in Detroit. After more than a century of being dominated by big business, the GMs, the Chryslers, the Fords, the new look of business in Detroit is small, nimble, and full of innovation.
But some are raising the question whether there's been an inordinate amount of attention paid to white entrepreneurs and male entrepreneurs. But is this really what's happening in the city? Well, let's talk entrepreneurism as we welcome Lisa Cook, who's an associate professor of economics and international relations at Michigan State University. Lisa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
As you've seen coverage, Lisa, of entrepreneurs coming to Detroit and beginning businesses and these startups, do you think it is skewed?
Yes, I think there is some coverage that is skewed of the kinds of businesses that are existing and cropping up. Certainly, if we look at something like the Inc. 100 list of businesses, top performing businesses in the country, Michigan has about 126 out of the 5,000, and some of them are in Detroit and many of them are not, but they aren't entirely new businesses, first of all. So the newness of this, I think, is somewhat skewed. And then I think that the other thing is that there's certainly a lot of coverage of the young people who are moving to Detroit. One of my former students is running an IT firm, course organization firm, and it's a Dan Gilbert spinoff. And there's much news about this because all of the news about Detroit has been, or much of the news, has been negative. It has been about the bankruptcy, has been about crime, mm-hmm. about Kwame Kilpatrick, about how businesses are failing, especially the auto industry and surrounding the bailouts. So I think that that's possibly why there has been so much concentration on this bit of good news.
So who do you think, Lisa, is being kind of left out in the cold when it comes to attention being paid to entrepreneurs in Detroit?
Well, I think women and ethnic and racial minorities. I think that if we look at the face of development of this burgeoning IT sector that's growing in Detroit, I rarely see interviews with women. I rarely hear about women who are participating in this, and I know that they are.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that narrative has been so focused on young white entrepreneurs?
Young white male entrepreneurs?
Young white male entrepreneurs.
Right. Well, I think it's because the narrative, again, about the disaster that is Detroit that's been portrayed in the media talks about sort of the demographics that are consistent with that everybody knows about Detroit. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that Detroit is predominantly black, but there's little coverage in the media of black businesses in Detroit and elsewhere.
That's what I'm getting at. Why do you think that myopia exists?
Well, this isn't the sexy stuff, right? I mean, the sexy stuff is young kids coming from all over the country and attracted to various businesses, don't want to single out any, that mm-hmm. are new and exciting in Detroit. And they're not the ones that, you know, an African-American kid coming back to Detroit from someplace else in the country, maybe Berkeley, wouldn't be an exciting story.
So the media is excited by, oh, look, here's a young man who's moved from Bloomfield Hills and he's bought a house in Detroit and he's working in Detroit.
Right, or somebody moving from Berkeley, California to Detroit, right? Not somebody or, you know, a white male student moving from Berkeley to take up a job here.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of migration patterns that are atypical, the story that is atypical, is the one that the media is looking for. And we can't blame the media for that, but certainly there are many dynamic businesses that are in Detroit that are, say, African-American and women-owned. This is more about the coverage of what's going on. And there's a dynamic black middle class in Detroit that is supporting many of these firms. But the thing that I'd also like to say, in addition to saying that, you know, Detroit needs every kind of business imaginable, one thing that I look at when I'm looking at the top businesses in the Inc. 1000 and the top businesses in Detroit We don't see the kind of match that we should see. We don't see businesses that are largely concentrated in the knowledge sector. And we need more of those kinds of jobs in Detroit. And this would be consistent not only with the national pattern, but with the regional pattern. Other states that are growing, say Massachusetts or California, we need more of those kinds of jobs. And African-American businesses, I've been looking at the BE 100, the Black Enterprise 100, for example, most of the businesses that are the top businesses in Michigan are related to the auto industry. They're parts suppliers. So I think that there's a bit of a mismatch between the businesses that are African-American businesses and the ones that are growing and getting a lot of attention in Detroit. And I think that that's an undeniable fact. That doesn't mean there aren't any.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if I'm looking on the Michigan Black Chamber of Commerce website, I see a number of businesses that are in logistics and in IT and in financial services and the knowledge-based economy. But there may be a bit of a mismatch there, and I think that it would behoove both parts of, or all parts of the business community to try to fill that gap.
Where do you think entrepreneurs can help Detroit go? Here we are, dismal headlines about bankrupt Detroit. What role do you believe that entrepreneurs and business owners can play in rebuilding Detroit?
Well, I think they have a big role. The first role I think they have is as lobbyists. They know, and when I say lobbyists, I mean in the broadest terms. I think they know what damage can be done to an economy if 50% of the adult workforce is functionally illiterate, right? So their voices are going to be consistently important, and they aren't the only voices, obviously. I mean, the parents of children in Detroit certainly want the best education for their children, and I'm sure their interests would be aligned, say, with the business community. So that's the first thing, is advocates for the best education possible that can be delivered to the students in Detroit. I think that's the first thing, because it takes an educated, skilled workforce in this 21st century economy to compete. And if long-term unemployment or just high levels of unemployment are pervasive, for example, in Detroit, there are skills that are not being passed around in various communities. So I think that these are two big ways in which entrepreneurs are critical to Detroit's recovery.
Lisa Cook is a professor of economics and international relations at Michigan State University. Lisa, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tanniskater, and Jeff Warniak. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.